I want to welcome everybody to the Second Court of Appeals for our second oral argument of the afternoon. Glad to see people back in our courtroom, of course, and glad that y'all were able to come and argue this. Before we get started, I will introduce the panel that you have here. We've got to my left Justice Brian Walker, to my right Justice Wade Birdwell, and I'm Elizabeth Kerr. I understand that the parties have checked in. We've gotten the oral argument handout that was submitted by the appellants, and unless there's anything preliminary, I think we're ready to call the case.
The court will now call Kobe Electric et al. Versus UMB Bank. May it please the court, Mr. Scott Lindsay will argue for the appellant. Ms. Jack Mason will argue for the appellee.
You may proceed, Mr. Lindsay.
May it please the court. Good afternoon. It's been a couple of years since we've gotten to do this, and it's nice to be back. After a very brief factual introduction, because I know the court's read the briefs and knows the factual background, I'm hoping to focus my time this afternoon on the jury waiver, which is issue one, and issue three, to the extent I have time, which is some of the issues with the attorney's fees. I will, of course, answer any questions that the court has, but those are the issues where I'd like to spend my time if possible. I won't go through them, but in tabs one and two of the handout that I provided you, hopefully will help with some of the kind of key witnesses and parties and an abbreviated chronology of the case, because we do have a lot of facts, a very long trial. Hopefully that would help in the court's conference and review of the case. My clients, the appellants, are Frank Soddy, Kobe Electric LLC, and Kobe International, Inc. Mr. Soddy is the 100% owner of both of those other entities. Kobe Electric was an LED lighting manufacturer, and it would source its products internationally from Kobe International, right? Kobe International had been around longer, and it would find that product, bring it over from China and other places, then would sell it to Kobe Electric. Kobe International was also subleasing space to Kobe Electric. Virtually all of Kobe International's income was through that process of the lease and the product. As you know, UMB Bank brought suit to foreclose on a note that was not repaid by the maturity date and to have a receiver appointed to liquidate Kobe Electric. Saudi,
we do not have any complaints with regard to the appointment of the receivership or of the conduct of the receiver or the trial court's approval of the receivership and release of the receiver, do we?
The fact that the receiver was appointed was not an issue that we have raised in the case. We certainly take issue with the fact that UMB went that route and sought the receivership when its own internal documents said this would they were
understood,
going to be
but
repaid.
How, but we're not, we don't have any basis. You're not asking us to reverse anything based upon the appointment of the receiver, the conduct of the receiver in liquidating Kobe Electric, okay, and the trial court's approval of that liquidation with regard to the amounts credited, et cetera.
Amounts credited, I need to quibble just a little bit because that gets it to our issue two argument.
That's why I've asked the question, because if there's a credit amount, okay, then how are we to say there's no evidence of that credit amount if, in fact, there's no complaint about the liquidation?
Well, because it was UMB's burden as the plaintiff below to show the court what that, here's what the loan was, here's the amounts that have come in, here is here's what's owed on it. Here's how you calculate the interest. And I know, and I'll be being candid with the court, Justice Kerr authored an opinion a couple of weeks ago about that often lenders are not required to have that detailed proof. But this case is, candidly, we believe is very different because we have no idea how that $3 million.
Yeah, well, so let me ask you, as I recall, what was it, Exhibit 659 or something was a breakdown of what the bank was seeking and the offsets and all that from the receivership proceeds. I think that was the exhibit that Judge Wilkinson excluded and didn't let in. Was that the only evidence presented at trial of what the amount of the receivership proceeds was?
There was no evidence, Your Honor, of any amount collected or applied by the receiver. I from memory, Your Honor, that specific exhibit that you're speaking to, I believe was additional charges and fees above and beyond about the loan.
I could be misremembering what was on that exhibit, but I just remember that it was attempted to be, it was introduced during Mr. Hines' testimony.
Would not those orders have been incorporated into the final judgment by their very nature?
The orders? Well,
for the receivership?
Yeah.
The appointment, approval of the receivership conduct in terms of the receiver had to come back and get approval with regard to the sale that was made and liquidation that was mailed. So those are all orders that are subsumed within the final judgment, would it not?
And those parts of it we don't have any issue with. It's that what
those
we
would be amounts, would they not? It would include amounts, would it not?
No, I don't believe so, Your Honor. I looked
back. There's nothing in the clerk's record or anything that would indicate the receiver coming back and saying, oh, by the way, here's what we liquidated those amounts for. Mm-hmm. Under the circumstances.
In the clerk's record, there could be. I'm not going to make that representation to the court. But there certainly was nothing other than Mr. Haynes' testimony or any exhibit at trial as to the amount of that loan.
Okay. Opposing counsel has said that Mr. Saad has confirmed all of the amounts that are required. Why should we not agree with that?
Because there's a case from this court that says when you're only essentially just repeating what someone else has said, that's not any kind of judicial admission. Let me find that.
Why is it not simply testimony that the trial court could then take into consideration?
If at best it rises to the level of some evidence. At best. And I don't think it is when Mr. Henry asked Mr. Saudi the question, if UMB is awarded this amount, and I'm paraphrasing, right?
Right.
If he is awarded this amount, is that what you're asking for as a credit against that amount or as part of your own judgments? And he says yes. I don't think that's any evidence of an amount that's due, but at best it still is a factually insufficient issue because at most it's some evidence, but it surely doesn't prove $1.3 million in interest and everything else. Application from receiver, et cetera, down to 1.3 from 4.5. So now let me dive right in. Oh, actually, I want to make sure I answer all the court's questions.
Sure.
But let me dive into in your handout exhibit, it's tab 3, the jury waiver language. There's a couple of legal issues that guide all of this analysis, and that is first.
Which is first, how are you going to keep me from getting reversed again since I was the trial judge in the Reeder case?
How about we just skip over Reeder, Judge? Let's talk about the one after Reeder.
Just needed to know.
But I do actually have Reeder first, ironically, in my outline here. But that just says we got to be careful about construing multiple documents together, right? And that's what I think that the bank is impermissibly doing here under the circumstances. But here's the other more overriding, let's pick a different Supreme Court case, Pinto Tech. There, they tell us that we've got to take into account the realities. It's ultimately a function of the intent of the parties as expressed in the document. Okay. Now, the court has the language in front of you. There is a comparison of two cases in particular that if we look at the two, we see why this case breaks the way that it does and why, respectfully, Judge Wilkinson made an error when she struck this jury demand. One of those cases is the Rubiola case from the Supreme Court. That's 2011. And in that case, the arbitration language says that claims between the parties had to go to arbitration, but parties were defined to include not only actual parties, but also officers, directors, et cetera. And so when individual directors were sued, they were included within the definition of parties and were therefore subject to an arbitration clause that said parties must arbitrate. Okay. Now, opposite end of that spectrum is the Black versus Diamond Shore case. It's in our brief. It's out of Houston, but there's a similar issue in Pinto Tech. But in the Black case, there was a jurisdictional waiver about Bermuda courts. Okay. And that agreement said that the parties waive any right to object to that jurisdiction. But there, a party was not defined as anything beyond what we see in our case, which is just successors assigns parties. Okay, no broader language in our view and reading of these. And that the Black Court held that the non-party defendants were not subject to that waiver because there is nothing within the agreement itself that expanded out to expand the definition of party. And that's what we have here. So let's take a look at this tab 3 and the language that UMB drafted in this case. And so that's all parties to the agreement. I'm looking at the top of the page, the business loan agreement. Okay, all parties to this agreement. That's who waives the right to a jury. Kobe International is not a party to that case. No one has said otherwise. The argument becomes later, and there's more to this, but that Kobe International is a borrower under those under this expanded definition and therefore waived a jury trial. Well, that matters not and is completely irrelevant because even if they were, a borrower has not waived any right to a jury trial under this business loan agreement. Okay, it's only the parties. Okay, so the bank then says, well, let's go over to the forbearance agreement, so we'll come down
just
the line.
Just for clarification.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. If we're looking at the entirety of the agreement, okay, the borrower is identified, correct?
As Kobe Electric LLC, yes.
But Kobe Electric is also identified as a party, correct?
There actually, as I recall,
in other words, borrower is going to be a subset of parties in the agreement.
I'm not sure I can agree. I'm not totally understanding. I'm not sure I can agree.
My question is, how can you be a borrower but not a party?
Under an expanded definition that tries to apply, say like the Black case, the Rubiola case, where you say these are the parties, but we're also going to apply this to others, officers, directors, et cetera. Okay, you can have that if parties is what you expand the definition of. That's not what got expanded here. Because, well, actually it did. Borrower got expanded, except the loan agreement does not say that the borrower is the one that waived the right to a jury trial. So it doesn't matter if Kobe International is included in that broader definition of borrower because the Supreme Court tells us we have to look.
But there's no doubt that the borrower in the loan agreement is a party in the loan agreement.
Kobe Electric is defined as the...
A borrower in the agreement is a party in the agreement. Without identifying who the borrower is, if you redacted out the names of everybody reading the agreement, a borrower would be a party because it's a loan agreement whereby somebody's borrowing money.
If
you then define borrower to include an expansive, then that would include them in parties, would it not?
In a hypothetical sense, I would have to agree with you, but that's not what the language is in this business loan.
So you're essentially making the argument that only the named entities and or individuals in this agreement can be considered to be parties.
Correct, because that's what the document tells us.
I want to skip. I know you're about to talk about the forbearance agreement, and I'm sure I'm picking up on something silly and trivial because neither side mentioned it, so I'm probably wrong, but I'm just curious, and I meant to bring a copy of it in here, and I forgot. But so on the first page of the forbearance agreement, you've got Kobe Electric LLC, parenthesis, quote, borrower.
Correct.
So that's a defined term.
Yes.
Right? But then later on that first page, as I recall, there's some sentence to the effect that a term that's not defined in the forbearance agreement would have a definition assigned, or capitalized terms. Help me out. Somebody's got that forbearance agreement. But there was a sentence in there that made me wonder whether, because borrower is defined in the forbearance agreement as Kobe Electric without the expansive affiliates mm-hmm. and blah, 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 whether that one sentence in the forbearance agreement would suggest that it's just talking about Kobe Electric there.
Well, I think it does because that is the only place we see a definition of borrower in the forbearance agreement, right. any place.
So I just wondered whether it would drag along any expanded definition from the loan agreements.
There, And I apologize that I'm not specifically recalling what the court is asking, but I do know that one of the arguments has been that the forbearance agreement modified the loan, mm-hmm. right, so that somehow you can use this. Now, but again, if we go to the express language, which is what the court tells us to do, we can't do that because the business loan agreement tells us don't use borrower, I'm paraphrasing again, but don't use borrower in any other agreement, right? So we can't jump from one document to the other. I will attempt to find that, Your Honor, while we're looking. I didn't bring the entire set of exhibits with me, but I will see what I can do about finding that. Now, quickly
okay. Let me make sure. I think I understand what you're saying. It's basically because the forbearance document references specifically borrower, but the loan agreement references specifically party with regard to the waiver. But the loan agreement itself defines borrower in two instances, one at the beginning as Kobe Electric, and then later it then says borrower includes affiliates. The question is, which of those definitions is dragged over into the forbearance agreement?
Neither of them, because if the forbearance agreement modified the loan agreement at all, it restricted the definition of borrower, not expansive. But secondly, the business loan agreement says you can't do that. You can't take either of those definitions from the loan agreement and use it in the forbearance agreement. And that's the express
language.
That's
solely because of the use of the word disagreement, the phrase disagreement with regard to that?
Well,
it would seem to me, since it's a forbearance agreement that is dealing specifically with the outstanding loan amount that's due, that the forbearance agreement in some way is referencing, if not incorporating, the loan agreement.
Let me, and to answer the court's question, and I know I'm out of time.
I tell you what, because this is an interesting and important case for all the parties involved, let's add 2 minutes to Mr. Lindsay's time right now, and you'll have 2 minutes added to your time as well. And okay. Hopefully we can...
And then I'll be
and
quiet.
And then Justice Birdwell can.
Okay. I believe I'm answering your questions when I say the forbearance agreement tells us how it is modifying the loan agreement. It is not necessarily an overall complete modification of the loan agreement. The forbearance agreement specifically says it's hereby modified as the context may require by the terms of this agreement, by the terms of the forbearance agreement. Okay. So we can't, when you actually look at the words on the page, we can't jump from document to document.
So Kobe International, to the extent Kobe International is not being looked to pay any part of the indebtedness in the loan agreement, the forbearance agreement can't be applying to them. That's essentially your argument.
I think that's right. Yeah, they're just not a part. Kobe International can't be reached for any reason, and it did not consent or agree to join these documents in any way. But certainly Kobe International is not responsible on the loan, and I don't think there's not been any contention that they were, short of some kind of a fraudulent transfer kind of claim to collect on the note.
If Kobe International, I guess, if I'm interpreting your argument appropriately, if they had not been a party to this lawsuit, then a jury waiver would have stuck. You know, they would, but because they are a part of the lawsuit, there should not have been a waiver of the jury, is what you're saying.
Actually, I disagree with that, Your Honor. And let me, if Kobe International went to and filed a new lawsuit, didn't get drug into the one, right now we got counterclaims we had to file. But if Kobe International had not been drug into that other case and filed a case tomorrow, I don't think that there's any basis to require to say that there is a jury waiver by Kobe International. They're not suing. These really aren't the arguments of the parties here, but Kobe International was not suing on a document, was not seeking benefits from a document or some agreement with the bank.
Well, and didn't Kobe International basically say that it agreed with UMB's suggestion that maybe the claims be severed out and Kobe International versus UMB be a jury trial?
Those were among the alternatives that were discussed on the record with Judge Wilkinson, yes. And I see that my time is over, and I'll see what I can do about that forbearance agreement. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. I'm Jad Masso for UMB Bank. I hope to not use all of the 22 minutes, but I appreciate it. I'll start where we left off dealing with the jury waiver issue, because I think that is the most interesting one. I think the answer to this question can be, well, it can be answered a few different ways, but I think the best answer is the simplest one, which Justice Birdwell, you hit on, which is let's look at the loan agreement itself. That is the central agreement that this case is about. Kobe International sued UMB because UMB was enforcing its rights under the loan agreement. So let's look to that one. And I think the simple answer is when it says all parties, who are the parties? The borrower and the lender. Some of the paragraphs in that say these are obligations of the borrower. Some refer to the lender. And in some places, it simply says the parties. I suppose we could have said borrower and lender instead of the parties, but some places we just said the parties. The easy explanation to this is that the parties means borrower and lender. And borrower is simply defined as Kobe Electric and its subsidiaries and affiliates. We know under the cases that we just discussed that affiliates can be bound by a jury waiver under these circumstances, and we believe in this case, very simply, in the loan agreement itself, without any modifications, without even looking at the forbearance agreement if we don't want to, that there was a waiver of the right to a jury trial by Kobe International. I think further, if you want to look and see what happened in the forbearance agreement, I think it ties in just as well, because that expands it.
But if there's a waiver, it has to be on the authority that is resides in Kobe Electric, because only Kobe Electric engaged in the was the borrower in the actual terms, because there was no indebtedness incurred by Kobe International pursuant to the loan agreement.
That's correct. Kobe International would only be bound as an affiliate. Only as an affiliate. It is not a party to the loan. It's not like Mr. Sade, who was also a guarantor. So they were not bound. We did sue them for fraudulent transfers. Mr. Lindsay mentioned that, but that's not at issue here.
Right.
Their only tie is an affiliate, and under that theory alone.
So where does the Supreme Court come down, since I'm still in therapy? Where does the Supreme Court come down? They didn't particularly care for the situation that we found in the Reeder case with regard to transaction participant.
Mm-hmm.
So how is Kobe International a transaction participant here where those parties in Reeder were not?
I don't believe that they need to be a transaction participant. In this case, they are bound as an affiliate because they're under common control and common ownership. This is more like Rubiola or any of the other cases that we cite that deal with affiliates being bound. You don't have to be a transaction participant. If you are under common control, if you are a true affiliate as the law defines it, and that really wasn't contested that they're an affiliate. That is, in essence, our argument for the jury waiver. It's pretty straightforward. I don't think it needs to be as complicated as the other side would like it to sound. It can be pretty straightforward. Unless there's other questions about the jury waiver, I'll speak for a few minutes about the damages issue. This court has, on a number of occasions over the last 20 or 30 years, reaffirmed the evidentiary standard by which a bank or any other lender can prove up the amounts remaining due on a loan. Of course, Justice Kerr, recent opinion in Tapia versus Collins Asset Group, restated that. And the only requirement, most of these, of course, are summary judgment cases. Really, the only requirement is that the lender put on evidence of the amount of principal remaining after all credits, the amount of interest accrued, maybe the interest rate, and we did that. That's exactly what we did. We said, here is the amount of principal remaining after all credits and offsets, and it was uncontested. Just like in so many of these cases that were summary judgment cases, it was uncontested. They didn't put on any controverting evidence to say, oh, but you left out this credit. Oh, but there should have been this other payment credited that wasn't there. Or you're calculating interest wrong, or that's not the interest rate. None of that was contested. So not only did we meet the standard, it would almost be appropriate for there have been, of course, this was a bench trial, but had it been a jury trial, it would have been appropriate for a directed verdict under the authorities from this court. I will talk also, I think we adequately met the burden with our own evidence. It was sort of icing on the cake that Mr. Asadeh also testified about the amounts due. And he went a little further than Mr. Lindsay suggested in his brief and just now. The testimony that he spoke about is, and all of this is in volume 18 of the reporter's record. He did talk about it constituting an offset on page 128 of volume 18. But if you go ahead a little bit to pages 136 and 137, he gets into a little bit more detail. And this is where Mr. Sade's own lawyer is questioning him about debts that Kobe Electric has to other people. And this is the question and the answer. This is on page 136. This is the question from Mr. Sade's lawyer. And the next obligation to UMP, the loan obligation offset, $1,326,901.72. You state, is an obligation of Kobe Electric and Frank Sade. Is that correct? Answer, yes. That is an obligation of Kobe Electric and Frank Sade.
Well, but wasn't that preceded by the previous question on, 128, where it was like assuming that this is the amount, would you agree that that's what's due? I mean, I'm paraphrasing.
Sure. On 28, he says basically, to the extent that's what UMB is seeking, yes, that's an offset. But coming back to it 8 pages later to say, that is the amount that you owe to UMB, and he says yes. And then on page 137, he's talking about amounts that would have been paid off at closing, like if the sale to Quabbin had gone through, the amounts that would have gotten paid out. They talk about it again and say all these debts would have been paid at the time of closing. And the answer again, yes, that it was a reasonable cost and it would have been paid at closing. If it was going to be paid at closing, I don't think he's saying it was just an offset. And we make the argument in our brief that this is a judicial admission, and I stand by that. I think this could be seen as conclusive proof, but obviously we don't need it to be conclusive proof. We need it to be factually sufficient proof for this court to affirm, and I think we've got plenty to support that. I think we probably had conclusive proof just with Mr. Haynes' testimony, but it's certainly bolstered by Mr. Sade's admissions there. Unless the court has questions on the other issues from the appellant's brief.
Let me ask a question with regard to the disclosure requirements with regard to, was the only objection made at trial vis-a-vis the failure to disclose the amounts of attorney's fees? Was that only based upon the failure to identify the expert's opinions, or was there an objection made under the disclosure rule with regard to the rule that requires that damages be calculated, how a party seeking affirmative relief in the form of damages calculates those damages?
It was the former. It was just.
I didn't say anything about the latter.
It was just the former, and I'm assuming the reason why is because these were attorney's fees sought as attorney's fees, not sought as economic damages, and so they wouldn't fall into that part of the rule. Unless there's any other questions, I'm happy to yield the remainder of my time.
Okay, thank you.
May it please the court. Let me return to jury waiver because I think that we have to change the wording of these documents in order to find that Kobe International waived a jury trial. There is not a plain language reading that reaches Kobe International. And if we get into changing the wording of the documents, then we have problems.
If we agree with you, what are the consequences for Kobe Electric and Sade?
Nothing. Those were not challenged. Believe me, I'd rather have a jury than a bench trial any day of the week for constitutional reasons. But
in other words, you're asking for a reversal and a remand solely of the claims that were brought by Kobe International.
Correct. Correct. The rest of the Kobe Electric, Mr. Sade's claims and defenses, and
so you're not arguing that we should remand everything back and retry it in front of a jury, including claims involving
on
Electric
issue,
and Sade.
On issue one, no, Your Honor. I have other reasons but not issue one. For the jury waiver is just Kobe International, and very quickly, let me touch on that as well. The briefs cover this, but there's multiple Supreme Court cases that tell us the standard is harmful if there are essentially fact issues, right? They actually say it. Several of them, half of them say it's not harmful if a directed verdict would be proper. The other half of them say it is harmful if there are fact issues, right? Which is the two ways of saying the same thing, in my opinion. And we've tab four of the handout. That's less evidence than what is in the brief, but it's the same evidence that was cited in the brief that goes through on the two claims for Kobe International and talks about what those fact issues are.
This relates to your position that because Judge Wilkinson denied a summary judgment, that therefore there were fact issues and.
There's more to it than that. That was a shorthand way, Your Honor, of candidly running up against word limits of a way to say there are fact issues in the case. But all of this evidence that is on these two pages of the handout is cited in the brief. It's discussed. It's laid out of why the fraud claims led Saudi to not take action and move the loan elsewhere. That led to the destruction of Kobe International as well. And this goes down through those elements of the two claims that Kobe International sought and lays out what those fact issues are, the reasonable probability, et cetera. A couple of things quickly about that. One, as far as whether UMB acted with any conscious desire, that hasn't been challenged by UMB in their briefs at all. And then as to whether there was fraudulent conduct, again, it's fact issues only. We don't have to prove anything, but this is not a sufficiency of the evidence. This is the same standard of would a summary judgment be denied on this evidence is the standard here. And all of this, we think, raises that issue. Let me just jump quickly in my last minute and a half to the attorney fee issue. That, you're correct, Your Honor, we did not say that they did not calculate as an economic damage. That's not part of the objection. The objection is that this isn't the objection. The objection is what Mr. Meso said that it was, right? That it was a disclosure issue. But for 15 years, the Texas Supreme Court has been refining and getting more and more specific about what we have to do with our attorney fees claims. And there are cases. Again, we acknowledge them in our briefs. They all predate Rormus. Now that we know what legally sufficient evidence, what opinions are going to have to be offered at trial, now we know what those opinions are. So this is
How are we to find that the ruling of Judge Wilkinson with regard to fair disclose, et cetera, okay, was an abuse of discretion when all the case law that she's relying on, granted pre-Rormus, or however you pronounce that, okay, but it still was looking at the interpretation of the court and including, I believe, the Supreme Court with regard to 194.2.
I'm personally not aware of any Supreme Court cases on it, but there are many appellate courts that have said, and for, you know, where this all comes from, Your Honor, is from the days where we all just eyeballed and ballparked attorney's fees. We had a $2.5 million attorney fee claim here before it got cut down in half on segregation. The Supreme Court has been treating this more and more and more as a claim that it is another element of damage that you've got to prove as any of the rest. And to me, saying that these opinions were not disclosed is actually interpreting the law and applying 194.2 to the Supreme Court opinion.
But to narrow it down, essentially what you're saying is that amounts and some degree of calculation have to now be part of disclosure given what the court has held with regard to the detail involved in the actual damages.
Hourly rates, the people that have been billing on the case, what's your number to date? Of course, you don't know in the future, but what's your number to date? Those inputs, and I know my time is up. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Gentlemen, appreciate the oral argument. Your case is now submitted.